My name is Jack Gilroy. I'm with Veterans for Peace, Stu Naismith chapter, chapter 90 of the national organization known as the Veterans for Peace, but I'm also a media coordinator for Pax Christi USA out of New York State, and I do a fair amount of work with Peace Action as well. I found out about Father David Gerlach only within the last month or two, and have recognized that he has a huge following around the world. Something like, and you can correct me, Father Gerlach, but I understand that it's over 600,000 people that have listened to your homilies, your sermons. And so I think we have a lot to talk about today, especially in the culture where violence seems to be predominating as a way of foreign policy. Could you tell us a little bit about your roots, your geographic roots? I understand that you're not a native to Hawaii.
Yeah, I'm from your neck of the woods. I was born and raised in Vestal, New York. Vestal High School grad of 74 and SUNY Binghamton grad of 1977. So, yeah, I lived my growing up years right there in the Triple Cities.
And so after high school, you went to Binghamton University. And then what happened after that?
I joined the Marinal Missioner Order, a Roman Catholic missionary order, and studied theology for 3 years with them. And having completed the requirements for the master's degree, left the seminary before ordination.
Do you mind if we ask why you decided not to be ordained as a Catholic priest?
They told me they really meant it about celibacy, and that was just not something that I thought would be a viable thing in my life. But the other compelling reason, even if that wasn't the issue, the election of John Paul II gave me tremors because I could see the direction that the Roman Church was going to be heading for the foreseeable future. His castigating of Ernesto Cardinal in Nicaragua at the time and his putting the brakes on progressive movements in the Roman Church were really distressing to me. So those are some of the reasons that I decided to leave.
And what led you to go to Hawaii?
My cousin Ed was a Marinal missionary for many years in the Philippines, and he had recently left the priesthood and got married. He had been deported by the Marcos regime during Ferdinand Marcos' dictatorship, and he came to Hawaii with a good friend of his, an Italian missionary, Gigi Kokio, because there's a large Filipino population here in Hawaii. So they thought that, you know, their dream was to go back to the Philippines, but while they waited for Marcos to be removed one way or another, Hawaii seemed to be a good place to be. And so when I left from language studies in Bolivia, and I came here. And it was just one of those things. I got off the plane and I knew I was home. And it's been home since 1981.
So 1981, you're in Hawaii. So what do you do? What sort of work?
Yeah, that's a good question. So if you have a degree in theology, there's only two things you can do. I think you can do social work or you can teach. So my first effort was to go to the local Marinal High School and see if I could get a teaching position. But the clergy here were very, very conservative. Hawaii and Mexico with Marinal had the reputation for the most conservative clergy. And so the Marinal priest, who was the principal of the school at the time, advised that he would never hire a Gerlach to teach in his school. So then I found work as a drug counselor at Hina Mauka Drug and Alcohol Rehabilitation Center. It's focused on the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the most profound spiritual steps, I think, since Ignatius of Loyola. And I worked there for 5 years, starting as a counselor, and I left as the deputy director. And in the midst of that, I had two goals in my life growing up. I wanted to be a priest, and I wanted to be a lawyer. So with the priesthood thing being kind of finished, I applied to law school here and was accepted and graduated in 1989. University of Hawaii Law School, yes, and ended up being a trial lawyer for 22 years here. And in the mid-80s, we found the Episcopal Church and just found a home there because the liturgy and the sacraments, I was all very familiar with from my Roman Catholic upbringing, but they got rid of the things that seemed to me to hold the Roman Church back. They got rid of the misogyny and the patriarchy and the homophobia. So I found a really good home there.
Could I just take a step back before? I'd like to pursue what you're just saying there a bit more, but what sort of legal work did you do? Were you a prosecutor or a defender?
I was in private practice and mostly a plaintiff's lawyer. I had a general practice, but my primary focus was as a trial lawyer. So I did criminal work, including a murder case. I was fortunate to have a number of high-profile cases here, one where we sued the Island of Hawaii Police Department for civil racketeering because they were promoting guys by handing their favorite candidates the answers to exams in the bathroom before the exams. And they ended up paying $6 million to the affected police officers. I represented the head of the Department of Public Safety, a woman at the time who was subjected to a lot of sexual harassment in her position, and also a very sizable jury award for her. And we represented, my partner and I represented one of the Bishop Estate trustees, which was a gigantic piece of litigation here in Hawaii. I don't know how much play it got on the mainland, but we were in trial for 6 months in that case. These Bishop Estate is the largest private endowment of schools in the world. They were the beneficiaries of an endowment by Hawaiian royalty. They built Kamehameha Schools, which is dedicated to serving people of Native Hawaiian blood. But the trustees let all of that power go to their head. And so they were earning millions of dollars a year and treating people around them not well. And so there was basically a revolt of the Hawaiian community against them. So I represented one of those trustees, the most hated one, actually.
What is the term that Native Hawaiians give to individuals who come in from the mainland or wherever?
Haole.
Haole. And
yes.
Do you know any background to that? What, haole?
It seems to have different meanings depending on who you talk to. One that was quite famous was ha'aole, which would mean no breath, but Native Hawaiian speakers say, no, that's not really what it means. It really is just a name for foreigner, for person from the outside.
And that could be the mainland of the United States, even though Hawaii is now a state?
Well, sure, because people haven't forgotten that the reason we're a state is because the Queen was illegally overthrown by American business interests supported by the U.S. Marines. And then a subsequent nearly century-long effort to stamp out the Hawaiian culture, forbidding the language, forbidding the hula and so forth, only to have the Hawaiian Renaissance in the 1970s reclaim Hawaiian heritage, the language. The language is now spoken throughout the islands, and Hawaiian culture is celebrated every day here.
And would you mind, before we move on to other issues, to let listeners know something about Queen Liliuokalani and how that all developed? Because I don't think that's a bit of American history that is often taught in schools.
Yes, Queen Liliuokalani was the last monarch of Hawaii. She was the one confronted with a bayonet constitution by U.S. business interests. And she faced a choice of whether to engage in calling her people to fight back against the folks who were seizing power or not to spare their lives. And she chose the latter. She was a devout Anglican, which is now Episcopal. She was very close to the Anglican bishop who supported her and opposed the intervention of the U.S. business interests. And she became a prolific author and songwriter. And so her words continue to resonate today. She is a hero here.
Thanks, Father David. You taught me a bit as well. Now back to the issue of making that change, the dramatic change, being raised in a Roman Catholic family, going to a Roman Catholic seminary, very nearly getting ordained, and now you come to Hawaii, you settle in working with social work and drug issues, become part of it, and then become a lawyer. And then all of a sudden, there's something about the priesthood that comes back to you. There's a story there that just tell us what eventually made you make that decision to, in a sense, leave law and put on the ministry of an Episcopalian priest?
It wasn't really an all of a sudden. It's always been there. And I think it's something that many of us who have been ordained have experienced, this kind of hound of heaven where we're constantly looking over our shoulder and saying to God, yes, thank you very much, but not yet, not yet, not yet. I was very active in my home parish of St. John's by the Sea in Kahalu. I was a lay preacher, a lay reader. The priest there at the time became a surrogate dad for me and a very powerful mentor. He's a native Hawaiian priest, Father Charlie Hopkins.
Now, this is an Episcopalian priest?
Yes, Episcopal priest, yes, yes. And he supported my urges towards ordination. I actually started to down the Episcopal priesthood line in the mid-1980s. And then my wife at the time, Issa, got cancer, and she died when she was 39. She died right after I finished law school. And so that sent me and God on kind of a not a very good relationship for quite a long time. And it took me a very long time to recoup from her loss and the devastation of her loss. And so after that passage of time, I still felt that call to ordination. And so I started it again in the early 2000s. And once they were satisfied that I was sufficiently dipped in the Anglican tradition, the bishop here agreed to ordain me as an Episcopal priest.
Did you have children?
The two of us, no, we did not. That was one of our hopes and plans. Mm-hmm. So, but I will say that all of that grief and difficulty, if I have anything of wisdom to give to anybody these days, that's the well that I draw it from.
So you began as an assistant, or were you made immediately a pastor of a church?
So I was actually able to become the vicar, which is the title for an Episcopal priest in a smaller church of my home parish, St. John's by the Sea. And so I was the vicar there for 2 years, part-time, continuing my legal practice. And then I was called to be the rector, which is the name of a priest for a larger church in a parish in the inner city of Honolulu in 2009. And at that point, I started to make the move to leave my law practice behind, and I was the full-time rector there for 14 years.
Who were some of the people that were parishioners of yours? Were you dealing with the very wealthy people, with tourists, with the poor, or?
So St. John's by the Sea was a collection of native Hawaiian people. The area of that island is a fishing village traditionally, and university people, because Charlie Hopkins, Father Hopkins' wife, was a university professor of Hawaiian language, and so she drew many of her colleagues and students. At St. Elizabeth's, it was a very interesting mix. This was a parish that was in the inner city, surrounded by public housing. During the 50s and 60s, kind of the mainline church heydays for all of our denominations, it was mostly Chinese immigrants and their descendants. And by the 70s and 80s, they tended to be quite well off. But what had been a neighborhood church where neighborhood people attended when it began 120 years ago became a suburban commuter church, so that the church was basically locked up at all hours except when Sunday services were going on. And it was on the cutting block for the diocese. My predecessor went there, and the first thing she did is cut the locks off the chains on the fences around the church and started welcoming the community back with reading programs and outreach to the folks who lived in public housing. And then I picked up from her when she retired, and we kind of put what she was doing on steroids and got quite aggressive in bringing the church to the people, which in turn brought people into the church. So we had a very extensive outreach program. We provided services to the houseless on a daily basis. We created the first Catholic worker house here in Hawaii, named after our mutual friend, Wally Inglis. And that is continuing to go strong. We organized marches for people from Micronesia who were denied Medicaid. Even though we blew up their islands and destroyed their culture and allowed them to come here without visas, and they could work here, but they couldn't get a lot of our benefits. So we used to do monthly marches for a year from our church to the federal building, and then Our Micronesian friends would go in and lobby our congressional delegation to restore Medicaid coverage for them. And we succeeded. That finally passed several years ago. So we tried to maintain a balance. We spoke or sang 5 different languages at every service, because for some of our members, that they only spoke their home language. It was a very exciting place to be.
Those Polynesian people that came to Hawaii, isn't it true that a lot of them were sent there because their island was so high in radioactivity, and that some of them had after effects, including leukemia? Isn't that a situation?
Yes. The people from the Marshall Islands sustained the really bad radiation consequences, because that's where these bombs were being let off. The folks from neighboring Micronesia sustained their harm a little bit less directly, but because of so much U.S. military involvement and replacing sustainable farming with canned meats and white rice, the fish in the ocean in that area are dangerous to eat because of radiation poisoning. So yes, they weren't really sent here. They were allowed to come here under our treaties with them, but they did so because life over there is so bad. In the early years, when we just started working with the homeless here, we would go to see people in the parks, and we'd have to go after 5 o'clock because everybody who lived in the park in a tent was working, but they couldn't make enough money to afford a place to live. But when we would ask them, why are you here? Why don't you just go home where you've got property, you know, you've got land? Invariably, the answer was, as bad as this is here in the park, it's worse at home.
Wow. Radioactivity and all that goes with radioactivity.
And all that goes with it, yeah.
Well, you made a statement, I understand, at one time by climbing a fence into a nuclear facility. Could you tell us a bit about that? I think, wasn't Wally Ingalls with you and Jim Antonelli?
Jim Albertini, yes, yes.
Albertini.
Yes, yes. 4 of us climbed over the fence at Westlock, which houses nuclear weapons here in Hawaii, back in the early 80s during a Palm Sunday anti-nuclear demonstration. And we were promptly arrested and then released. And then we went to trial because we wanted to make a statement. So we had a 1-week trial in federal court where we were able to at least make our political arguments in a way that attracted a fair amount of media attention. At the conclusion of the trial, we were all found guilty. We were all sentenced to 1 year of unsupervised probation. And the trial judge, a very famous trial judge here, Sam King, whose family goes back a couple hundred years, this is during the Reagan times, said, better luck next time at the polls, and let us go.
Could you expand a little bit on that, the Hawaii and the whole nuclear threat, and the fact that Hawaii, and not just Oahu, but all of the islands, seem to be quite militarized? What is the general attitude of people in Hawaii about the militarization of their islands?
The 3 main components of our economy are construction, tourism, and the military. And from my point of view, sadly, a majority of the people here are very supportive of the military presence. The military has huge operations here, many bases. Of course, that makes us a prime target in the event of a nuclear war. And they have recently contaminated our drinking water. They had huge underground storage tanks built during World War II to hold jet fuel that have been there for some 80 years now almost, and they began to leak because of poor maintenance. And they leaked into one of our aquifers. So there is ongoing concern about getting those things removed. They've been drained, we're told. Removal is hopefully the next thing. But the military has done a lot of harm here. But sadly, economic interests tend to overwhelm the bigger picture, I think.
We all know it's over 80 years ago that Pearl Harbor was bombed, but that there is one ship there that has been leaking oil ever since, and that the U.S. government refuses to take care of that because they want it to be a symbol, a historic symbol of Pearl Harbor and being attacked. Do you have any information on that?
I don't. You know, I've lived here for nearly 45 years, and I've never been to Pearl Harbor.
Wow. Yeah. Well, a lot of people kind of forget the fact that it really wasn't a state at that time, but nevertheless, they still use it and speak of it as though it was a state, but it was the territory that you have already explained, taken by rich Americans, plantation owners from Queen Liliuokalani and the native Hawaiian people. Now, back to some other issues here. For example, not too long ago, you wrote a book, and I'd like you to possibly tell us a little bit about the book that you wrote, Jesus Christ, He Still Matters. And why does He matter? What is the essence of what the book is about, Father Gerlach?
What I learned during my ministry, particularly at St. Elizabeth's, was how distorted we have made the gospel of Jesus Christ, and how unlike the gospel too many of our churches are. And this, I think, is across denominations. We've tended to model our faith on the Rotary Club, where every parish or every church has a group of like-looking and like-minded people trying to do some social good and trying to feel good about themselves, but not much past that. Whereas the Gospels call us to erase lines between people and knock down walls that we're so quick to build up and see beyond the narrow blinders that just about every one of us are born with. And as we get older, we tend to add to them. So this book is it's a collection of sermons and stories and some poems that I've written that tries to explore what Jesus maybe more authentically calls us to, which is this openness to the whole world and an openness to all people, especially the ones who are different, whether they're different because of their sexual orientation or their race or their ethnic background or their language or their economic status. None of those things really matter, because the ultimate truth of our faith is that we are called to be one with God. And if that's who we are in our essence, then all of this silliness that we do to each other has got to be challenged and examined and then let go of. And that is the hope that I entered into writing this book, and that's the hope I continue to have when people who read it is, here's a different way to take a look at things than maybe you've been raised with.
What you're just saying resonates so much with so many people, but unfortunately, they don't hear that when they go to their Christian church, whether it's Catholic, Anglican, Episcopal, Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterian, whatever. They don't hear the forthright statements that you seem to be making. And from what I've heard from your homilies, your sermons that you have posted on Facebook and, of course, on YouTube. What is it, Father Gerlach, that ministers, priests fear? What is it that they fear that they cannot tell the truth to their parishioners?
I think as human beings, we're almost programmed to look at the world in terms of us against them and to define our lives in that way. And to actually come face to face with recognizing that can be very painful and very difficult. I think with clergy, very often on the Anglo-Catholic, Anglo-Protestant, and then the Protestant side, ministers are worried about being fired by their congregations, because in our traditions, it is the congregations who hire and fire ministers. On the Roman Catholic side, I think clergy are worried about upsetting their bishops and their superiors, who can make their life very miserable. And as I mentioned at the outset, when John Paul II came into power, he appointed an awful lot of very conservative bishops across the whole world, so that it's fear at the end of the day. And faith is supposed to let us not be afraid. I mean, the most commonly used phrase in all of Scripture isn't go to church or remember to play bingo. It's don't be afraid throughout Scripture. I think Richard Rohr counted and came up with, it's found there 365 times, you know, enough for one a day. Whether it's true or not, the point is, don't be afraid has to be the clarion call to all of us, whether we're clergy or lay, to pursue Jesus, because it is a fabulous calling. But we have to remember, where did the guy we're following end up? He ended up hanging from the cross. And if that can happen to the boss, you know, I think we have to be willing to say that might happen to me. but remain faithful.
Father Gerlach, what would you advise ministers and priests to do to really fulfill the Christian vocation that they have of love, peace, and justice, which isn't that pretty much the heart of Christianity?
It absolutely is. It has been said many times that Christianity is not a religion, because religion is about human beings seeking God, but Christianity is about God seeking us. So the whole thing is turned on its head. And too many of my peers in the ministry are just focused on the four walls of the church and on the sacraments and on the rituals, no different than if you're selling insurance, where your whole focus is on selling insurance. We're selling religion. But that's not the call of Jesus. The call of Jesus is to transform this world, is to transform all of it. Christianity is not a call to individuals to accept Jesus as my personal savior and then I'll be saved and the whole world can go to hell. It is a call to create communities. Salvation is communal. And at the end of the day, it involves everybody, the whole world. And we forget that when we get focused on our personal peccadilloes, when we get focused on our own personal salvation, because it's not about me saving my own fanny. Jesus did that already for all of us. Our job is to get on with the business of planting the kingdom seeds here and now. Not so much with words, but with how we behave.
What is your reaction, Father Gerlach, to the fact that there's something like 20 million Christian Zionists in the United States versus like 9 million, I think, is the population of Israel? And do you see any real threat to our culture with the white Christian supremacy, Christian nationalism?
It's a huge threat to our society. It's a huge threat to the faith, because it's not Christian, it's not patriotic, it's all about power. And the ironic thing about Christian Zionists is that it's entirely self-serving. They don't have any great love for Israel or the Jewish people. They are all caught up in fever dreams, misreading the book of Revelation, and thinking that they can force the second coming of Christ, who's they have turned into some kind of modern-day Rambo, who's going to kill all of their enemies and bring them into somewhere and have this select group of the saved while everybody else is living in hell, which is so far removed from the message of Jesus as to be laughable if it wasn't so horrible. Christian nationalism is about creating a small group of white men to lord it over everyone else. And this, of course, goes hand in hand with the right wing's Project 2025, which is intent on returning us to essentially a plantation economy where a very few wealthy people rule and the rest of us only exist to serve them. Now, this has been an ongoing effort since the 1950s, when a guy named Kavanaugh wrote a book outlining exactly where he wanted this country to go. And if you read his book and follow that blueprint, they have been very successful at it, from seating the Supreme Court with right-wing activists who are no longer judges but are simply right-wing activists, to the success of the Republican Party, which by the numbers ought not be in power at all, but they have managed to rig the system in such a way that they continue to win even though they are a minority.
What about the Zionists operating in the United States, such as the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, better known as AIPAC? What is your take on AIPAC, Father Gerlach?
Well, I think the genocide in Gaza is the consequence of their long history here, and the refusal of politicians on both sides of the aisle to condemn and stop Netanyahu's massacre of people in Gaza, it's inexcusable. And yet, the money is there to keep people quiet, and that's a real shame.
And what's your take as well on the extrajudicial killings? And as a lawyer, this must seem very strange to you that you said you did one murder trial, that here we have 87 murders that have occurred in the Caribbean and the Eastern Pacific by United States drones primarily, you know, knocking out most likely many of them fishing boats. But there is no Fourth Amendment due process here. There's no boarding of the boats to make arrest or eventually having hearings or grand juries or trials. It sounds like kind of a dangerous situation. What is your take as both an attorney and as a man of the cloth?
I've been speaking out against this since the first murder occurred back in early September, because it is unequivocally a war crime. It is unequivocally murder. Drug running, even if that's what they're doing, and so far there hasn't been a scintilla of evidence that that in fact is what's going on. And you'd think that they would produce it if they had it. But drug running is not a capital offense. We don't kill people for that, even though they've had full due process. But more to the point, I think, Trump is not opposed to drug running, because if he was, he wouldn't have pardoned the former president of Honduras who brought in 500 tons of cocaine into this country. What it's about is causing terror and an effort to use power that is unprecedented. And since the Supreme Court gave him effective king-like immunity for his actions that are even remotely related to the core functions of the presidency, he is taking full advantage of that. I'm without words sometimes when it comes to the atrocity that this is. There's a lot that's wrong with our country, and there's a real lot that we have yet to fix. And we have engaged in illegal and unnecessary violence against all kinds of people, particularly the people of Central and South America, for well over a century. But Trump has just put all of this on steroids, and even trying to have a face of common decency is gone with this guy.
A couple more questions. The one before we move away from the concept of militarism and the very threat that we have to nuclear war. Under the Biden administration, under all of the administrations, really, that we've had over the last 70 years or so, there's been this hate Russia sort of campaign. We thought all that ended back in 1991 with the fall of the Iron Curtain and eventually the United States declaring that they would not proceed to the borders of Russia. Russia would be pretty much on her own. It was even a time where people talked about Russia joining NATO. NATO instead has become a very aggressive group with weapons up onto the border of Russia, with threats of nuclear weapons, with American soldiers actually in Poland and Romania. You were way out in Hawaii, but the threat of the world really seems to be most dangerous with the risk-taking against the Russians, boxing the Russians in. What is your feeling about maybe abandoning NATO, of just eliminating NATO, and that maybe Trump, who we criticize so strongly, maybe this could be one of his achievements to finally come to some sort of diplomacy with the Russians rather than threaten them and threaten the whole world, really. As a lawyer, as an attorney, and most of all as a Christian, what are your thoughts?
Well, George W. Bush was part and parcel of the whole military-industrial complex in a very big way. He depended on it his whole life financially. And he's the one who really began that expansion toward the Russian homeland after the fall of the Soviet Union. And then it was continued by subsequent administrations. So there's no doubt that the driving force of military manufacturers who depend on the next war to make their money is causing this kind of drift toward what could be a complete catastrophe. The reason that I would not be very hopeful about Trump departing NATO is not because it would reduce the threat, but I think Trump's worldview is one where he sees himself, Putin, and Xi of China as the three monarchs of the world, that he wants to have three areas of control, with each of these major powers controlling their area of influence. So he sees himself as kind of a dictator of the Western Hemisphere. I think that is much more dangerous than continuing our alliance with NATO, if only for the reason that the Western allies are still somewhat rooted in democratic principles and are still somewhat willing to push back on Trump's authoritarian efforts.
The flagship newspaper of the United States military is Stars and Stripes. I remember reading it as a young soldier, a young infantryman myself. Just last night, a former governor of Montana, formerly a lawyer with the U.S. Army, stated that what is happening in the Caribbean is illegal and that soldiers should consider not following orders. I wonder if that message gets out to Hawaii as well.
It does. And the problem is that the JAG officers in the Pentagon, who would normally be vetting questions like this and prohibiting this kind of action, have all been fired. And so up and down the chain of command, all that remains are sycophants. And so to leave those decisions to the line soldier, which, you know, they have a duty to say no if it's illegal, it's cowardice on the part of the command structure that we have in place here.
I'd like to ask you a question about women in the church. You mentioned that you became an Episcopal priest. One of the reasons was celibacy, and the other just wanting to serve the people. What about Roy Bourgeois? Roy, of course, also went to Mary Knoll, became a Mary Knoll priest. Roy decided that he was going to test the church by calling for the ordination of women. What are your thoughts about Roy and him being defrocked and the whole situation? Will the Catholic Church, in your opinion, ever accept women as priests?
I know Roy very well. He was at Mary Knoll while I was in the seminary. We had many opportunities to interact. Roy was very active in fighting against the School of the Americas in Georgia. And they were the ones who trained the right-wing terrorists in Central America to kill their own people. Roy was subsequently laicized because he stood with women who were being ordained and spoke in their favor. You know, somebody said, do you believe in women priests? And my response is, I not only believe in them, I've seen them. We have women priests in the Episcopal Church, and they are some of the finest servants of God that I have ever had the good pleasure to work with. And their call to holy orders is no less legitimate or real than mine or any other male priest. The Roman Church is built on patriarchy, and the justification that they use for not ordaining women is that to be a priest, one had to be with Jesus during his initial public ministry and experience him in the resurrection. Well, who did that? Mary Magdalene did that, as well as several other women, according to the Gospels. So what does the Roman patriarchy do? They elevate Mary Magdalene to become the apostle to the apostles. So no, we're going to put you on this pedestal so that we don't have to allow you to be one of us. The disingenuous, dishonest theology that supports a male-only clergy, it's quite simply laughable. I was sent to Suwannee at Southern University, Suwannee School of Theology, as part of being prepared to be an Episcopal priest. And one of the wonderful professors there walked us through all of the theological reasons why women could not be ordained and demolished each one rationally, logically, and scripturally completely. And if the Roman Church ever wants to get honest with itself and say that, yes, this is all about culture and patriarchy and nothing about theology, they will come to the same conclusion. And I hope one day they will. Because to me, this whole sexual abuse scandal, it has a lot to do with mandatory celibacy. Because when you have mandatory celibacy, you are going to, by nature, bring in people who are sexually immature into this priesthood. At least half of the Roman clergy, in my experience at least, were gay. And I'm not suggesting they were active sexually, but their orientation was gay. Let's face facts. There have been gay people since the first caveman walked out of a cave. There have been trans people since that time. Why have we made our faith all about being the sex police instead of trying to build the beloved community? And the answer is, it is easier to be the sex police over my neighbor than to fix myself so that I can uplift God's kingdom. And we need to face that fact.
Oh, boy, this has really been interesting. And Father David, what would you advise Christian priests, pastors, male or female, to do and to speak to their parishioners, their congregations? What would you say if they were to get up this coming Sunday and speak to their people about faith and justice and the peace of Christ, what would you advise them to speak to?
I don't think you can say it unless you're living it. So if you're not living it, you need to start living it. And then you'll find the words to say it. But it has to start with the clergy. I mean, I can't give you what I don't have. And as I mentioned before, too many of our clergy are stuck in the church as if it's just another company, another corporation, another job, instead of a call to transform the world. So until and unless we're out there actually starting to do that, we have nothing to say about peace and justice and God's kingdom to the people in the pews.
With your book, Jesus Christ, He Still Matters, what are some of the essential or the stories, the sermons that you tell about? Could you pick out a couple and tell us what they're about and what people seem to resonate with in these stories?
Let me do two different ones from different perspectives. One from just a personal pastoral perspective. I talk about the difference between being healed and being cured, that so many people turn to God when they're sick, and when they remain sick and sometimes die, faith is lost. I went through this in my own life and experienced that difficult road. But what I also experienced was, in looking back at my wife's illness, was that even though she wasn't cured, she was healed. She glowed at the end of her life. And so I tell stories along those lines about different people, some who are healed and cured, some who are cured and they worry that the cure is going to disrupt their healing, because when they were sick, they changed and they saw life differently. And now that they're cured, they think, I'm just going to go back to the rat race. Will there even be a healing? And some, like my wife, who were not cured, but who were healed spiritually and emotionally and psychologically in a very deep way. The other aspect is more along the lines of the Christian nationalism threat to us, which I think our congregations, as they currently exist, with too many having this club mentality of what the church is, only fosters, is that we can no longer afford to have different camps of human beings. We have to see ourselves as a common humanity. One story that I love to remind people of is Thomas Merton, the famous Trappist monk, also a devout peacemaker, stood at the corner of 4th and Walnut in Louisville, Kentucky, and had this epiphany where everybody he saw walking around in this busy town was one with him. They were his sisters, his brothers, his siblings. And he asked the question, what would they say if they knew that they were all walking around glowing like the sun? This is who we actually are in our essence. And unless we can grasp that and hold on to it and get rid of the nonsense of bigotry and prejudice and men rule women and people of color are bad and third-rate citizens, unless we get rid of that, Jack, it's as you said it. We stand between salvation and Armageddon, and I don't see a middle path. We've got to choose one, and I choose salvation. There's a lot of us talking about this, and I think the reason is it's not because a bunch of us geniuses suddenly landed on the planet. I think the Holy Spirit is moving in this world and directing anybody with ears to hear the Holy Spirit to this place of moving toward communion and community.
What is refreshing about your pitch, Father Gerlach, is that you don't seem to fear the common criticism that is thrown at people who are in parish work, and that is that you're too political. You're willing to speak out when you see that there are political issues that affect all of us. Can you tell us a bit about what you see in the dangers of over 70 million people just seem to be supporting Trump down the line? What is that going to change, or how can it change?
I think it will change. I think he's got a relatively small core of true believers who will never change. I think there's a lot of folks who are able to be convinced that believing his promises was a mistake. My response to people who complain about me as a clergyman talking about politics is this. Politics is how we live our life, and religion is how we ought to live our life. And if these two things are not in constant conversation, then both are in serious trouble. They have to go hand in hand. And every great preacher in our whole tradition has followed the belief that we preach with the Bible in one hand and the New York Times in the other hand. That if faith cannot talk to our present-day reality, it is empty and useless. It is the salt that has lost its flavor, and it's good for nothing but to be thrown out. And we need to be salt in this world.
You mentioned earlier, Father Gerlach, about Palm Sunday. And when that Palm Sunday comes up to me, I often think of, is Jesus the protester, the radical, in that the procession really was a rally and a protest. How do you get across that idea to people who look upon those of us who do protest and rally, you know, for peace and justice as something that is a historical event?
Yeah, I mean, Jesus upset everybody that he came across. He upset the religious elites, he upset the middle-class Pharisees, and he upset the guerrilla warriors, zealots, all for different reasons, but he pissed all of them off. Pardon my French, but he did. And that's why he ended up on the cross, not because of some grand scheme for God to send him down to get brutally murdered for us so that God could then forgive us. This is topic for another conversation, but it's a complete mischaracterization of what the faith ought to be about.
Maybe we should jump back into and expand on the genocide issue and ask ourselves, why is it that even though Pope Francis, each evening up until the night before he died, spoke to the pastor of the only Catholic church in Gaza, the Church of the Holy Family, yet there are many Holy Family churches in the United States that pay no attention to Gaza or no attention to the Christian message that seems to be what we should be dealing with Gaza. Could you expand a bit on that about Christianity in Gaza and why it seems that the Zionists seem to be winning over?
It seems to me that the Palestinian people have been so marginalized that they're hardly even seen as human beings by most of the Western world. And a lot of that has to do with the successful, unfortunate lobbying of important Israel Zionist support groups here in our country and around the world. Historically, anti-Semitism has been recognized as something horrific, and it is. It resulted in the Holocaust. What's so tragic is how the right-wing Netanyahu government has weaponized anti-Semitism into genocide. And then when he's criticized for it, looks all aghast and says, well, how can you possibly say that to us? Look what Hamas did to us, which is true. The Hamas attack was horrific. But to exact a retribution of what? 40 people for every one who was killed, including women and children indiscriminately, supposedly by a society that's better than that? I don't know the answer. I don't know the reason for our nonchalance and our complacency. Perhaps some of it has to do with the fact that we haven't been a very politically active nation since the 1970s, and two generations have grown up being politically nonchalant and noncommittal. And nothing really bad seemed to happen from a lot of that time, at least to them. Well, that's changed now. And these chickens are coming home to roost for all of us. So if there's anything good that is coming out of the horrors of Gaza, it is that I hope it's woken a lot of people up.
How about the recent killing at Bondi Beach in Sydney, Australia? 12 people celebrating Hanukkah were assassinated, were killed. What is your take on that versus, you know, the assassinations by the tens of thousands in Israel itself?
Right. I mean, again, any murder is murder. Any murder is horrific. But to use those as a justification for mass slaughter, it's not excusable. It was ironic that it was a Muslim man who disarmed the Muslim shooter. This effort to paint an entire religious faith with the crimes of a few is kind of the calling card of this administration. There was a congressman recently who called for the deportation of all Muslims from our country, including U.S. citizens. This kind of over-the-top demonization of people, it's being used against immigrants from Central and South America, where one or two bad guys commits a horrific crime here, and the entire population is smeared with that. It's a way to gain authoritarian power, and it's being used quite effectively. And sadly, critical thinking skills in our nation are at an all-time low.
Do people in Honolulu go out onto the street to demonstrate in opposition to Gaza?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've been to several large anti-genocide rallies here in Honolulu. And at the last No Kings Day, Gaza was prominently featured. And opposition to Israel's policy there was prominently featured here. And we had over 10,000 people just on our island show up. And there were thousands more on the outer islands as well.
Well, that's encouraging to hear because the activities that we have had here in your old hometown of Binghamton, New York, in fact, there have been three major No King's Day activities, one in April, one in late May, and then just this past October. And only on one occasion has anyone spoken to the Gaza situation. And I have to admit, it was me. I wasn't asked to speak. I went up onto the stage, and at the very first event that they had, there was only one person in the crowd, a young Muslim woman with a sign that said, "In Gaza, genocide." And I spoke to that, and I spoke to the young woman in they were shocked, actually, because they allowed me to speak because I said I was a veteran. And they were, since that time, there has not been one word. In Binghamton, we had 2,500 people at the next No Kings event. The following one, there was close to 5,000. Not one word was said about Gaza, but we did have signs. And we were told by the leaders of the No Kings event, which is indivisible, to please get off the courthouse steps and take our signs down because that is not the message that they want. And it is interesting that the National Indivisible has not said a word in any of their events as well. So thinking of Honolulu and people speaking out there, I congratulate you, and I think that that's wonderful that you're doing it. I wish that it would catch on the mainland.
Yes, yes. And I intend to stay active in that issue with our local Indivisible group.
So when something does occur in Hawaii, demonstrations, protests, rallies, etc., for peace and justice, does the local media and the national media stationed in Honolulu pick up on that?
The national media does not. The local media has been uneven. The last rally, the biggest one that we've had in October, landed us on the front page of the local section of the paper, not on the front page above the fold where it should have been. But we carry the stench of corporate media just like everybody else in the country, and they are beholden to Trump, as they have proven over and over and over again. It is shameful. It is truly shameful.
Father Gerlach, before we go, if listeners were interested in having you on a Zoom, let's say, would you be willing to do that, to have a Zoom dealing with some of the issues, especially issues dealing with your recent book, Jesus Christ, He Still Matters?
Oh, I'm most delighted. The most important thing all of us can do, especially in this day and age, is to try to bring people to the gospel of Jesus Christ, because If anything is going to save us, it's that, where we begin to recognize our common humanity with everyone else and start to live out of that common humanity. I think then we can regain our sense of decency. We can stop the kind of horrible talk that is allowed these days. People who post puppy dogs and hearts on their Facebook, and on the one hand, and on the other hand, calling their neighbor vicious names. We need to stop that and regain who we truly are. And I think we can do that. So I'm happy to talk to anybody anytime about that.
So before we go, we just want to say thank you for writing Jesus Christ, He Still Matters. I know I have the book, and I hope that we can all begin to think more along the lines that Jesus Christ still matters, because we're at a point in history where it's Armageddon or peace. And that's not a very good choice just to have Armageddon as the other side. But that's where we're at with 9 countries with the nuclear weapons. Thank you again, Father Gerlach, and I hope we can meet sometime in person. And if you're ever willing to come to the cold regions of upstate New York, for sure we will invite you to speak here. But in the meantime, I hope that you make your own tour of the United States. So thanks again.
Thank you so much, Jack. A pleasure speaking with you, and very best regards to all of the folks listening. Blessings and peace to all of you.